Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi lads, thanks for tuning into the podcast again. Don't forget to like and subscribe and head over to the Patreon to contribute and help us out. Thanks a million and enjoy the podcast. Hello everybody, welcome back to the Two Nordies podcast. My name is James and I'm joined by my good friend.
Hi everyone, Timmy.
Timmy Long. Rowan, as always, is on the deck. Say hi, Rowan.
Hi, Rowan.
As you can see, myself and Timmy are getting closer as the weeks go by. Isn't that right, Tim?
Yeah. I'm actually 40 now, so...
Bit too old for me.
Yeah. That and the vaccine. I'm actually eligible for the vaccine at the moment, so it's a good thing.
They'll come to the young people next. Yeah. But we digress, yeah. Tim. We digress.
But James, I'm after being told that I actually look younger than you.
There's a lot of spoofs out there, right? There's a lot of spoofs out there. But look, what about the guests? This week we have one of our neighbours. Mm-hmm. It's her. You're the first person to come on this podcast twice.
Yeah.
You were our first room. Your name is Susan Walsh, and you're joined by your handsome husband. Mark, how are you keeping?
I'm good, lads. Yourselves?
Thanks. Not a bother. We know a small bit about Susan. Do you want to tell us about who you are and where you're from?
Yeah, certainly. Well, as you said, my own name is Mark. I'm originally from Kerry, but I'm in Cork. Jesus, I'm in Cork. Donkeys now at this stage. Mm. Almost earned myself an honorary Cork title at this stage.
Almost.
Almost is right.
Not quite.
I suppose got to meet Susan, what was it, 12 years ago?
Yeah.
When we first started going out around Christmas 12 years ago. And our wedding anniversary, our third wedding anniversary?
Fourth.
Wedding anniversary.
Oh, you're dead out for any of
that. Yeah. It was April just gone.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so.
And can you want to tell us a little about how we met?
Yeah.
I know. I know. Like when a man and a woman meet, there's two different versions of what happened.
Go with the male version first. Yeah, no problem. As I said, there it was on the lead up to Christmas. The year eludes me a bit now, but it was on a night out. Certainly, well before COVID. Like so, it was the city was well in full flight around Christmas. It was a social night out. Actually, I was out with a colleague of mine from work. Tommy Mazur. Hi Tommy, if you end up watching it.
Hi Tom.
Inside in Long Island. Met her in Long Island. And it was back in the days when Suze was working in River Island. So managing River Island in town at the time. And big fashionista at the time. Like, so she was, if I remember rightly, you were working that day, weren't you? You were,
yeah.
Dolled up to the nines. And she had a red feather boa. on like that particular night, so you couldn't miss it, to be fair. She was in there with two of her colleagues, and we were obviously at the bar, myself and Tommy or whatever, and I was kind of drawn to that and the antics that were going on in the corner, and just while we were doing our own thing, like, but I was obviously looking back maybe a bit more than I had realized on the particular night, and caught ourselves eye, like, and eventually between the jigs and the reels, anyway, she came over and in too uncertain words, just call me out for what are you looking at, kind of thing, and what are you going to do there now about that or whatever. And I paraphrase here now, and I'm probably misremembering, but it's something along the lines of pull up a stool here or something, and we'll see how that goes, you know. And the rest is history, believe it or not. We actually ended up staying together that night, as in traveling around, and we had a few more nights out during Christmas and stuff after that. And it's actually funny, you know, thinking back, like, given the context of where we're on today, it actually almost feels like I'm talking about a different person than myself, and I'm talking about a completely different couple with myself and Susan when I think back to the people we were individually, and you know, the kind of couple that we grew into from that night, completely different. You know, it's like, I won't say it's surreal, like, but it just feels a bit weird talking about it because it's almost a feeling of disconnect because we've changed so much individually and collectively together, like, since then.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you want to...
Oh, my contribution was Dun Vatican Luke's age. That's what I remember saying to him. But I was caught by, I was looking across the bar and he's so tall and I was like, fine, bit of a girl. He's all right. No, I was half cut, like, but thanks. I still was like, I don't know. So I would, like you said, I did approach him, saucy out, like, and said, "Are you going to keep looking?" Like, or what? What's the story? And he was like, it is like a different. In some ways, it's like a different. It's like a different couple. The kind of madness and the fun is still there. It's just, it's just not the carnage and the alcohol isn't there because we still go out. Like, obviously, now not with COVID, but do you know, in the years past since. Recovery and stuff, we still go out. But yeah, it was a bit of a mad time even thinking back.
Yeah, you spoke to us the last time, Susan, about your issues with alcohol, you know, and you're in recovery. Do you know when you met your husband Mark, what way was your drinking at that stage?
I suppose it was bad, but I surrounded myself with people that it was less obvious to. Do you know, and like as Mark said, I was managing Reverend at the time, so it was kind of, I was able to minimise it and kind of justify it because it was the scene. Do you know, I kind of got away with like, oh yeah, work hard, play hard, you know, a lot of this crap, you know, but the reality was I even needed a drink then. But, and I mean, I said this to you the last time, I mean, I was very confident. It wasn't about that for me, it was just about, I worked so hard, genuinely, like, as in physically worked a lot, that, like, to keep going, to keep up with the party life, and I had to keep drinking. It was kind of like, you know, I was on this vicious cycle. And I remember when I met Mark, he was like somebody I'd never met before. Like, as in, we met, I remember within a date after that, and he came into Clancy's bar and he had a suit on, and I was totally freaked out. And I was like, what's the wrong suit? He was in work, like, and he was like, and I was like, oh my god, he's a man. But I remember thinking, he's a man, like, I'm a girl, and which, like, we were the same age, do you know what I mean? And he was like, "Hurry!" And I was like, oh my god, I don't know about this, because it was just not the kind of person I was used to being around, and I would have minimized my drinking even at that stage, kind of early on to Mark, or I would have just kind of played off the fact that, well, I'm from the north side, that was kind of a big part of, that's what we do, what's wrong with you? Because he would have kind of said it early on, even, gosh, he thought the party was going to end even after the first week or two, speaking for you, but you know, it didn't.
Did you see red flags early on, Mark?
I didn't, lads, to be honest, and I suppose, like, I was just thinking there now while Susie's talking, like, the fact that it was Christmas in it to begin with, you know, like, straight away, like the whole country is out of their mind, like, for Christmas, and it's perfectly acceptable. And, like, to be fair, I wouldn't shied away from a couple of points myself at the best of times back then, not mind around Christmas. So it's kind of like when we met there, like, it was actually a bit of a tsunami, if you will, for that 2 weeks of Christmas, because, like, I had an awful lot, we planned socially, like, and we just kind of really clicked really quick, and Susan just automatically fell in. So, like, I was going to things that I should have been going to, we'll say, in my own, under normal circumstances, had I not met her, but she was just tagging along, and we were going together, like, and we were just drinking on, and it was grand, and thought nothing of it. And I suppose it wasn't until, like, well into the new year and beyond, the kind of first thing that I kind of remember that struck me was morning afters, as in, she always needed a cure, you know, and like, obviously there's plenty of other people that could do that, but myself personally, I suppose, I normally tend to have done the dog in it, and like I was never one for the hair of the dog the following day because I just was too sick. I couldn't face it, like, and it was always, it was a must have, like, and it was always a cider, cans of cider, like, so like if we were going out, if I was going out to get anything initially the following day, whatever it was, hangover grub or water or anything, I always had to get cans of cider as well, do you know? And I, like, that was the first thing that kind of struck me. I mean, it wasn't a red flag per se, but, like, you know, it kind of turned into the topic of a conversation several times after that thing, going, what's the story with the cans anyway? But you just kind of got on with it, and we were kind of distracted about more kind of other things, but there wasn't anything kind of seriously happening at that stage, we'll say, outside of that, for me to kind of go, whoa, what's going on here?
The behaviour was fine. And stuff
yeah,
like.
Exactly. She Suze was very good there in that regard, that in the early days, outside the hangover, I was completely oblivious, to be honest.
Yeah. That was your first time, really, so being around anybody that had any form of addiction, alcoholism or drug addiction, so you're not going to really know what it is, because you probably never seen it previously to that with another family member or anything like that.
Yeah, completely directly. Obviously, like I would have known people indirectly or known of people like down the years like that were sufferers from it, and I've seen it from afar, but I hadn't experienced it firsthand in the home or directly like that either.
There's very little scenarios where having a drink first thing in the morning is accepted. Mm. Maybe if you're at a wedding and you get up the next morning, you're still in the hotel and you congregate around, people might have a cure. Yeah. But for people watching, if they have kind of concerns, if your partner or loved one is waking up in the morning, they have to have a can. That's a red flag. Mm. Like, there's no version of reality is that normal behaviour. Would you agree, Susan?
100%. And I'm actually kind of, even thinking there, that was a total must for me from the very start. Even when I started drinking first, going out on a Saturday night, I'd only go out if the girls were definitely going to go out on Sunday. Mm. So I had to have the drink. And I remember actually we used to have arguments about the whole can thing, because rightly so, because it's normal behaviour. Mm. Martin's going to say, can you not just leave it off? Like, I'm dying as well. Shall we just get a munch or we just chill out? And I was like a lunatic. I was like, no, I have to get a few cans. Like, you have to get me cans. I have to have cans. Knowing that it wasn't normal or acceptable, but it was my normal and my acceptable. Mm. So he was the one with the problem then, not me. Do you know, just, all right, will you just get the cans and I'll leave it off, or we shouldn't go at all. That was kind of the attitude, which was all wrong on reflection, but that's where I was, do you know.
And just on a point there, actually, which is something else that came to mind there too, is like it had a lifespan in that. The cans had to be bought within a certain time, and I laugh now, like, but when I think back, it kind of had to be picked up within a certain time zone of her waking up, or else the day was gone. Do you know, from a sickness point of view, she was no good to nothing. So, I mean, like, to your point when you were talking about weddings and stuff, like, there were some days, all right, like, where we might have planned to go out again the following day, like, with the aim of getting a cure at some stage in the afternoon, but... Or whenever, but it was us going somewhere as opposed to kind of drinking at home.
It's a special occasion, like.
Yeah, or whatever, like even just a bank holiday weekend or over where you went out a Saturday and you're the Sunday or equivalent of a Saturday night and a Monday. Do you know, we'd planned to do that. Like, I kind of would have needed a couple of hours to get myself gathered kind of thing, but it was a must. And then, like, there was a few scenarios for whether I was just too sick or I just didn't go up myself to get it. Like, we missed that window, and... To be fair, like, she was literally no good for the rest of the day, then we wouldn't end up going out or doing anything else. So kind of on the back of that then, like, I kind of stayed quiet initially then once I saw that, because I thought, you know what, for an easy world now and not to spoil things, I got the all can so that the day could endure after that, you know. But I suppose when you called out the red flags as well, I mean, the last thing that would have ever entered my mind at that stage was to be vigilant for anything around red flags to do with drink, like, because, you know,
it's something that wasn't on your radar previously.
Zero, like, I mean, even as mad now as it was, and we had some mad nights out and everything, it just was in a completely different world to me. It was nowhere near my radar to be looking out for anything like that. Yeah.
And by that stage, you were obviously very much in love with her, and you couldn't have just walked away from the relationship because you had feelings for her.
Yeah, as in, it was still kind of early days when I'm talking about that now, like, but, I mean... In relation to love, like, I can't pin down when, like, but I obviously did have a lot of feelings for her. And I suppose kind of when I think back in with the luxury of hindsight, you know, and after years of introspection and proper analysis of it, I kind of look back and there's part of me that probably subconsciously might have known, like, that there something wasn't quite right. And for various different reasons, you know, I kind of left it sit for a while because, like, we had plenty of other good things going on and it wasn't like we were going out 6 or 7 nights of the week, like, you know, it was kind of the weekends or, you know, one night of the weekend maybe, or depending on what was going on during the week. So it wasn't constant in that regard in them early days. Yeah. And it certainly wasn't gone to the stage where I was kind of questioning, you know, the risk over the reward kind of thing, or is this is this kind of hassle worth, you know, like we weren't at that stage yet, at that stage of our relationship.
So now, regards to the drinking, Susan, now you have a good few years in recovery now, and obviously you do some personal development along the way, and can you pinpoint or maybe understand a little bit why the drinking was so chaotic, and maybe how you addressed it in recovery and what were the things you did to address it?
I think, genuinely, I think for me, like, I do think it was kind of like a learned behaviour, do you know what I mean, from very early on, that just became then habitual. Like, when Mark said there, do you know that she got so sick, she wasn't good for nothing. I was physically dependent. Like, again, that's great. I'm sitting here in a podcast, I'm always physically dependent. I didn't know that at the time. Do you know what I mean?
I know.
I was just like, oh my God, I'm dying. I need a can. Like, I didn't have any of this level of awareness. But I was, my body, everything we needed a drink. Like, so, like, what I used to do was, like, I was very sneaky, like, do you know what I mean? As in, like, Mark wasn't, he wasn't aware of that. Like, the nights I wasn't with him, of course I was drinking, do you know? Whereas, like, he'd see the nights I was drinking, but he wouldn't see the other nights. I'd be still drinking. We were living together as well. Mm-hmm. So I had the capacity to hide it, and I was working full time. Anytime he did meet me, I was like, do you know, all dressed up, all the business, story, you know, looked like I knew what I was at. But, like, secretly, I was tormented. And I was terrified to tell, I certainly wasn't going to tell this handsome new fella that I met that I was weak about. But I was waiting, I could be half an alcoholic. And that's what I was even thinking. I was like, maybe there's something wrong. I don't know. But there was no way I was letting go of it, because I didn't have anything else in my life at the time other than work. So, and that was how I felt, you know what I mean? I was like, I only have work. That was like my lifeboat. That's keeping me afloat now. And then he came into my life, so I had that. And I was like, and I need drink to keep all these things spinning.
Yeah.
So, like, stopping didn't come into my head until I lost everything.
Was your family and friends on your case about it?
Not majorly, like, because
like, you said it on the last podcast, and we talked about it, like, you presented really well. You were always dialed up to the nines, you were working in a good job, and you could never have known from the outside looking in that you had all this alcoholism going on in your life.
Yeah.
So did you mask it from your friends and family as well?
Yeah, and lied. Like, you know what I mean? Masked it, lied, minimised it, like, just kind of fobbed it off a bit, you know, put it down to culture, put it down to, no, yourself, no, girl. God, he's on my case, don't be allergic to him. Do you know, like, that kind of, that was the story I spun myself and I told other people. Was I consciously lying? No, but I was lying. Do you know what I mean? It was obviously my subconscious to try and protect my addiction at all costs. And the biggest thing for me, James, would have been that persona. Like, once that slipped, that's when I really crumbled. Do you know what I mean? As long as you saw me and I was done up to the nines, well, then I'd make shit together in my head. Like, and it was when all that started to fall apart, years of drinking and other substances came into my life, that then I was like, oh, now I have a problem, because it's visible. And that was one of the ones somebody said to me. She said, like, it's going to affect how you look physically. My hair was falling out. If them things didn't happen, I genuinely think I would have stayed drinking. I don't think, because I don't think I could have stopped for anyone or anything with the best of intentions. Just wasn't able to stop, you know.
I can definitely relate to what you're saying there. You know, drink does something for you that no person or thing on the planet can do for you. You know, and it really takes everything, you know. And you spoke about towards the end there, all these different things were happening to you. It can be very, very difficult to stop if you've nothing in your life that you're willing to fight for, you know, and obviously you did in the end, and obviously you did fight for it, you know, because we're sitting here and we're talking about it, but I can definitely relate to it, not wanting to stop, because if you stop, you don't know how to cope, you know, and I suppose if you don't have people around you that that know what addiction is or alcoholism, you're not going to understand it, and you're going to hit your rock bottom fairly fast, you know, and sometimes that can be a very, very difficult situation for anybody and for family members as well, you know, because it's very, very difficult to watch a loved one harm themselves physically and mentally.
I'd say it can be a quite isolating place for you to be as well, if the family doesn't really know, the friends doesn't really know, but inside you know yourself deep inside.
Terrified, like terrified. I remember once, I don't know if you probably remember this stuff because we spoke about it, we have spoken about it. Remember once I said it to Mark, we were up in Barrett Street, and I said, I think I might be an alcoholic. I mean, there were so many things put in front of it. Mm. Do you remember that? And even saying it, I was like, shit, I shouldn't have said it. No, but I was just so laden down with the burden that, because I was sick of making excuses. I was sick of having to, you know, say, or we leave tonight off, or hiding the wine, swapping the wine out before he'd come home, or trying to make, you know, or get into arguments, and I'd be trying to defend myself, and then I'd be getting thick, do you know what I mean? I'd be getting saucy then and giving him like an awful time, yeah. And he was being reasonable what he was saying, but I was just like, oh my god, I'll pay in the hole. But that was because I needed the alcohol completely from a selfish point of view. Like I just needed it, and it was something I carried around. I mean, it was a doctor rang me and told me that they tested my liver, and they did all blood tests, and the doctor rang and she said, I just want to bring your attention to something, and I was like, oh yeah. She was like, there's severe damage to your liver, and it's a serious indication of alcohol abuse. And I was like, oh God, will I tell him now? I was like, oh, will I tell anyone? If I tell anyone, they're all going to tell me stop. Yeah. And I can't really hide it anymore. And I did tell Mark that, but I tried to minimise it straight away. I gave him the news, and then I went, Sean Rush is on the boat. I'm changing doctors. Mind her. Telling me then that I've a gammy liver cheek, for I was in Australia. Of course I've a gammy liver.
Get another one.
Yeah, I changed that. I was like, I'm changing doctors, not food.
Do you know why we're laughing? Because we can relate to exactly what she's saying. The denial of it.
The madness of it.
You will try absolutely everything in your power to protect the addiction, Mark, you know, to protect your addiction to drugs or gambling or anything or food. There's so many across the board, you know, so that's why we're kind of laughing. I know on a personal level, like, you're watching somebody that's really harming themselves, and it's tough for you to understand.
Well, I suppose just on that as well, just a bit of kind of context from my side of the table on it, because you kind of in that story there kind of fast forwarded to wasn't over like a couple of months or a couple of weeks. That, like what Suze has talked about there, like was over kind of, that was a couple of years, do you know? So that wasn't overnight. And I suppose the other thing is, I think I know so yourself that used the word culture. For me, in those early days, beyond the can days, we'll say, even though that was still in the mix, there was a couple of pivotal things like that kind of kicked in when I suppose I started becoming a bit more, hold on a second now with this. And not only that I started becoming a bit more vocal about, hold on a second now, like, no, like, or stop or what, you know. And like, Suze used to stay a lot with me, but we weren't technically living together. But like, we did kind of progress into living together. And then obviously when that was one huge pivotal point, because she was with me all the time outside of work then, you know, so when she like came home from work in the evenings and et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing was, like, I never would have been a big man for drinking at home myself, you know, unless in all party, all hours of the night, like, you know, as in I'd kind of go out to the pub because I like the social aspect of it as well. So when Suze moved in then as well, like me going to the offy for bottles of wine turned into this kind of regular thing then as well. Mm-hmm. Something that I wouldn't have been privy to prior to her moving to me, because she'd buy a bottle on the way home to her own place, and I wouldn't know any of that. But like, I knew then, we'll say, all the times that the bottles were coming into the house, because more often than not, it was me that was going to the offy to buy it. So then obviously when I was getting that, then I kind of started kind of zoning in a bit there in that regard. But like, funny again, and I suppose funny is probably the wrong word, even at that stage it became about, like, I was just questioning, why do you have to do this? You know, again, I wasn't thinking Susan's got a problem like an alcoholic. I might be thinking you're a bit heavy on the sauce there at times, kind of thing. Like, and I remember we used to have conversations. Could you not just leave it till we go out the weekend? And you know, we'll go for a drink together there at the weekend, as opposed to the bottle of wine every evening and stuff. But it came back to the culture, because she'd said it to me again. Like, and I'd saw her colleagues doing it, getting on to her, and you know, I'd go to the offy there up near where whatchamacallit used to be, that pub has gone down the north side, the Holly there, do you know? And I'd go in there, like, and anytime I'd go in there, it was packed, or whether I was dropping her off or I was going in there myself. So like, it just seemed really normal. But like, it wasn't normal to me. But then I was thinking, look, think about where you're coming from now compared to Suze, like, in our small village down in Kerry, like, Suze is like from the ticket and Northside manager in River Island, like writing the ticket for it in Cork City. So that's for me kind of tied into the culture. But I suppose when we did start work living together then, and our relationship started getting stronger and deeper, then I suppose I felt like I had a bit more of authority to actually start speaking up. Yeah. And I did start speaking up. But I look back now and I'm actually almost embarrassed and confused at how kind of ignorant or naive, you know, or whether I was in a sense of denial at the time, like to it, like that I was just thought.
Hindsight is always 20/20.
Yeah, of course.
And you don't have the benefit of that and you're in the moment, so don't be so hard on yourself. But I was thinking about like when you got with her and you were going out the weekends and, you know, it was great, you know, the drinking was fine. But the more contact you had with Susan as you grew closer, you then start to see more drinking, you know. So
yeah,
the more you were around Susan, the more you were drinking. She was drinking all the time. You just began to see it more as you got closer.
Totally. I just wanted to the point Susan made about telling me that time. I think that was actually in town, if I remember right, as opposed to. But it was kind of like the way it was said. It was almost like, you know, she no sooner had it said that she kind of brushed it off again. Like, and I remember thinking, what? What are you, like, you're feeling sick or whatever, like, and like we ended up staying out that night again, like, and the following day I remember saying it to you, you know, kind of quizzing you on it, and it was completely brushed off. So like, again, like, to your point, hindsight being 2020, like, I obviously alarm bells should have probably gone off at that stage, and I'm embarrassed that it didn't. But like, I was just thinking, look, this girl certainly drinks more than anyone that I've been with before, like, and certainly drinks more kind of at home and during the week than I would be used to myself. But I still didn't think, oh, Susan's an alcoholic, you know, like, not at that stage of a relationship. That hadn't come into my head.
I just to say as well, that's because, like, addiction is insidious, like, and it was so sneaky, like, and I was so sneaky. So, like, when you even say, you know, I didn't cop it,
you did your best from that to cop it.
Job wide, like, do you know what I mean? New handbag, every measure that was in place, I had it in place, like clockwork, do you know what I mean? I knew exactly what I was doing to protect my drinking, and it didn't matter. And it was just to kind of, I was just open fires then, do you know, when the conversation came up, to try and diffuse it, to make it sound like it wasn't as bad as it was. So, like, I can say it myself, I own it, like, a master manipulator, do you know what I mean? In deflecting from my own behaviour, and putting on his behaviour, or saying, you're wrecking my head about this, when actually it was because what I was doing was completely wrong, and I knew what I was wrong, but I couldn't stop it, and I was too ashamed to say anything about it.
I suppose you didn't have any awareness around it either yourself, because you weren't really around anybody in recovery at the time to understand your own actions, you know?
Absolutely, and it was a coping strategy. I used it my whole life. So it was like, what? Of course I'm going to do this. Like, it was my soother. Do you know what I mean? It was my soother as an adult, right up until, and I could never imagine life without it. I was like, how do people, that's not a reality. That can't be a world people live in. That wouldn't be my reality. Do you know, we drank every night. Everyone I knew drank most nights. When I say we, not me and you, but people that I knew. So to me, almost like, he was the weirdo. Do you know what I mean? I was like, what? This is weird. Why don't you want to drink? Whereas it was, and then like it came to a head when we were living together, because it became visible and it was harder and harder to hide it. And then the deception from my side had to creep in, because I had to defend the drink.
Sorry, Tim.
No, I was just going to say something there. You know, sorry to cut across you.
Walk away.
I remember towards the end of my own addiction, you know, my wife had to lock the doors with keys and windows. She'd have to plank all my shoes in the house. You know, she'd take everything, and I used to climb out the windows and I'd find a pair of slippers or whatever. And winter nights, I'd go in a short pants, right? I might have a light little jacket, it'd be raining, but I'd be going looking for a party, right? But my point is in the house around those times, I would have a bag of drugs planked in every single room of the house. You know, every single room. And that's what it done to me towards the end. And I didn't understand that either. Was it like that with drink?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was one instant. Do you want
to? Well, I just smile now. I smile now. And you know what? Like, I'm just so grateful that we can smile about it. Like, because I'm not smiling at. You kind of made the point yourselves earlier about some that you're laughing, that you weren't laughing at that per se, because it was humorous. Like, but like, I just smile back, as in, like, I think to your point, when the deception kept in, and because I was kind of in your face a lot more often because we were living together and I was getting more vocal, it became harder for her to hide. And like, unbeknownst to me, like, this only came out in years later, like, and I mean, it's only even in, like, I'm still getting bits of it, like, over even the last 3 or 4 years that I didn't know what was going on, you know. So I was completely unaware to so much. But like, when it was escalating to the stage where Suze was kind of getting to the level where, like, yeah, this is serious, there's a problem here, and the narrative and the language was changing more towards addiction, when we were getting towards that, like I was finding, like, empty bottles, you know, under the sinks and in wardrobes and, Jesus, in cushions and inside in toilet, everywhere and anywhere, like, basically, yeah. Like, but, like, I remember when it happened first, like, it's kind of upsetting thinking about it now, but, like, I remember being so confused, and, like, it probably sounds silly now, like, saying that I was confused, you know, because I was thinking, like, I think back, like, geez, you should have had more cop on or been a bit more intelligent. But, like, I was just confused about what's going on. And then I remember confronting her, and I was very binary about things because I didn't have a full understanding or awareness of the enormity of what's going on. So it was just binary to me at the time. Like, why are you doing this? And, like, you can't, like, you basically have to stop, or, like, this is, you know, or else. And then when she didn't, and when I found it again, like, I took it as a personal attack on me then, you know, because she was disrespecting me, again, not knowing the enormity of what was going on. And it was like, F this and F that, what's going on? And then confronted her again and made up, and there was loads of promises and stuff. And, like, to give her due there now as well, like, I don't want to be kind of painting her, like, in a bad light all the time, because I have to be accountable for a lot of stuff back then as well, because I can confidently say now, like, did I enable that, even though I didn't realize I was enabling it at the time, because I did enjoy our social life. Like, I really enjoyed us going out together, you know. And, like, funny enough, there was a lot going on back then from my side, between wedding, with a lot of weddings, and there was a lot of kind of festivals and stuff that we were going to, and I'd be a mad GA man, and a lot of matches we were going to. We were going to Dublin, and we were going to matches in Parky Queeve, and, like, a lot of social stuff where drink was related. And I actually liked Susan being with me.
Would it be fair to say her drinking and her ability to drink suited you?
In those instances, completely. Completely. And, I mean, I can look back now, like, and, like it's not that I won't say shame or anything, but, like, I certainly will take responsibility in relation to, I feel like I enabled it in those moments from a selfish point of view, because we were a couple. You know, we our relationship was very strong at the time. I'd introduced her to all my circles. All my friends loved her. My family loved her. Like, when we were out, even together on our own, we used to have great crack. Everyone liked meeting us, liked being in our company. So there was an element of that. Like, so then I was almost kind of like, I wanted my cake and eat it a small bit at the time when I think about it, because I didn't want her doing it at home. But I was okay for her to do it then when she was out with me at the weekends. But, like, obviously, I still didn't fully grasp what exactly was going on with it.
Alcoholism is, like, all or nothing, do you know what I mean? It's like, I can't turn on and off, you know? And something, you bring up something there, it's important for us to kind of talk about around people that are watching, that they might think they have a drink problem, or they might think that family member. Hiding drink is a huge red flag. Hiding food, hiding medication, these are all very not normal, abnormal behaviours, you know what I mean? There's no reason for anybody to be hiding food or to be hiding their medication, be hiding their drink. No, that's a big red flag, so it's just for people watching. I'd say towards the end, like, was there a lot of conflict in the relationship? How did it end? How did you end up in recovery, Susan?
So, there's been so many chapters, like, you know, over the years, I probably misremembering the timelines, you know, like, I think we did break up when, and then
I think kind of coinciding what we were talking about there, I remember, well, it was a wedding that we had up the country.
Oh, yeah.
Above in Westport, and we were driving up, and again, I'm only laughing now because
the wedding, when I think back
at it, well, like, that, this was the kind of the straw that brought the camel's back for me in relation to, right, as in, like, something's got to give here, like, or like we're done, because like the behaviours, not only are they not changing, they're actually getting worse. But what it was Luke's aid bottle, and every time I see a Luke's aid bottle to this day, the memory comes back into my mind.
Vodka.
No, it was wine, white wine inside
in the Luke's aid.
I got to back in the end, but
we were pulling into some petrol station, whether you were going to use the bathroom or get cigarettes or something of that nature, anyway, like, and I told you to get a drink for me coming out, like a water or something. And she came on and just forgot the drink, like, so that was grand. We took off and I was like, I'm actually tired, but thirsty, but we were caught for time. So I made a beeline for the Lucid that was on the ground, like, so look, give me a drink of the Lucid just to keep me taken over so we can get back in the road. Like,
I say, your health sank.
She was being very cagey about the bottle Lucid, like, and I thought none of it first. And then, like, it just got really, really weird, like, and then I just managed to grab the bottle, like, and I took a swig out of the bottle, like, and it knocked me for six, like, as in not the drink, as in like the realization of, after all the conversations that we'd had kind of prior to it and where we were going, and very close friends of mine now as well, like, and kind of concerned that, you know, you'd keep it together at the wedding and said that you, etc. And, like, it was just whatever. And then, like, funny enough, to be fair to you again, like, and again, I think back and I think, in retrospect here again, that I was being selfish in that I wanted the wedding to go ahead, as in I was looking forward to going to it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to turn around and not and end up sacrificing that weekend with my friend, you know. So we kind of managed to talk it out and the forgiveness again, like, but between the jigs and the reels, anyway, like, without going into any great detail, further detail, that night escalated into something really, really, really bad, like, and that was kind of like the beginning of the end. It was the beginning of the end for us in that moment of our relationship. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was the beginning. It was the beginning of a real realization of you kind of looking into doing something from a recovery point of view or just some treatment point of view that you weren't trying up to that stage.
No, absolutely. And it's mad because I had been doing that for a while, the whole Luke's thing, and I remember, Jesus Christ, I went to the car just to open, like, and just and next thing you know, I was like, oh God. And I remember I still laid to his face, like, and said, it's not wine. And he was like, are you actually for real? I can taste it. And I was like, it's not wine. Deadpan, like, do you know. And I suppose for me it was just like, again, things were starting to come to head. Like, that doctor had said that in between, you know, there was, you know, my hair had started falling out. Like, there was other impersonal things, not collective.
There were starting to get some real consequences.
Yeah, exactly. There was stuff starting to happen to me. And obviously, like, Mark was blue in the face from saying, like, these were just repeated conversations, you know, that you can identify with. It was over. And I swear, and then rinse, repeat. I actually think what was one of the breaking points for me was I was exhausted. I was absolutely mentally tortured. It wasn't even at that stage about, like, saving anything. It was just, I'm actually wrecked. I can't keep doing this. Like, I actually just want to die. I prefer to be dead than keep doing this. So I reached out to, like, mental health professionals, because I was just like, I just want to kill myself. I can't keep going. I can't be who I thought he wanted me to be. This person that can drink and not drink. I can't. I'm making promises I can't keep. I'm becoming a liar when I swear that I'm this honest, straight-out person. I'm contradicting myself left, right and centre. I was hating who I was looking back at in the mirror. Do you know, regardless of what was even going on externally, this was all going on internally. Do you know what I mean? I was sickened that I was planning my route home with the wine bottles. I was sick of making excuses for all that constantly. Do you know, I was just exhausted. And then Mark was like, and that's what I'm doing as well. And I remember, like, and rightfully so, he was disgusted, like, do you know what I mean? Because we were going to a wedding, do you know, all dressed up, all the biz, and there's drinking in the Luke's aid bottle, like, hiding again, do you know what I mean? So I was becoming these people that I would have thought were, oh my God. But I was that's who I was, like, do you know what I mean? But I was pretending to still be.
Was there a lot of shame for you?
Massive. I couldn't face myself. I could not look and say, yeah, you do really have a problem. Like, it's amazing that today I look at people and say, and I genuinely mean it, being vulnerable is a strength. And I didn't believe any of that. Like, I said that today, and I mean it wholeheartedly, but I didn't believe that. That was weak.
Yeah.
Pick yourself up, dust yourself up, and you drive on, girl. Do you know what I mean? And me admitting I'm an alcoholic, that's I'm a failure. I'd start fucking everything up. No, you just keep going. And then it was because I was just suicidal. I was like, oh, well, where am I going to go now? And no one could help me in terms of, like, Mark tried to help me numerous times, gave me loads of chances. When I said no one could help me, I suppose I mean professional help. Mm-hmm. And there was a grandiosity to me that I didn't want to. I was.
You had this persona at the
of what it was and who I'd go to. And, like, I didn't fit in with going to an addiction counsellor or in my head, like, you know, even though I was a total addict. But in my head, I was like, no. So when I went to a professional and she said to me she couldn't help me, I was like, great. So I honestly was just like, delete. Sure. And then I was like, I was so messed up in the head that I was like, I'll probably fuck that up now as well. I was like, so everyone's going to hate me even more because I'm going to cause loads more misery on top of this. And she gave me a leaflet to go to, it was Fernand's actually, treatment centre. And I was like, what's the story with this now? Like, this is true. I'll have to give up my job. I was like, he's already after finishing with me and I'm already after to move back to my mum's. I'm ashamed. Like, all the shame was already there. And then it was all this new shame because now I've not this together person. Now I can't get up and get myself that up because I'm not able to do it because I'm so bait. So I was like, I'll go into treatment. And I went doing the best of intentions. I went in to see what's wrong. What's wrong with me? Yeah. Tell me what's wrong with me. Help me. But I still didn't think it was the drink. I did 3 months in there and Mark was still supportive. He's to he's to send me in letters, he's sent me in cards, like he used to send me in cigarettes even though I didn't start smoking until I went to treatment. That's not an addict, I don't know what is. Do you know, he used to send me chocolates, be supportive, his family were supportive, they sent me cards, even though we weren't together, he still was rooting for me, do you know what I mean? Mm. And I remember not smoking in finance and when the girls goes to me, but, like, do you know when you come out now, how are you going to deal with, like, if you meet up with him, like, if he wants to go for a drink? I was like, sure, I don't have a problem with drink. After 3 months of treatment. And swearing that I was telling the truth. I was like, no, you're not understanding. I had too much stuff going on in my life and I just needed a break. But I'm delighted and I'm so grateful for the break. Thanks. And I found God and I felt really spiritual and it was lovely. And I came out and 3 weeks later, went back to Mark and was like, I feel great, look at me. I looked good, you know, and it was like legit good, like, as in it wasn't all makeup or anything. It was the real authentic me, as I thought. And 3 weeks later, I was Langers. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know when you went back to your mum's after the split? Did your mum and your brothers confront you? Did you have to get real with them and honest with them? And how was that?
Yeah, horrendous. Like, again, would have been lying as well to them, do you know what I mean? I don't think it's there, and again, I'm only speaking from personal experience, but I think when I went back to the family home, I reverted back to being a child mentally, do you know? So, on top of being an addict, and feeling hard done by, and oh my God, my life, and all this. So, like, it was really hard. And, like, addiction fractures it doesn't just destroy you, it destroys everyone around you, do you know what I mean?
The ripple effect.
Yeah, and I own all that. But it wasn't good for me to be right back in the environment that I grew up my whole life in, because all the associations were all there. Like, I couldn't even go to an appointment without passing the offie. So just even environmental triggers were everywhere. And again, I didn't know these words then. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know what this meant. Like, so it was inevitable that I drank, do you know? Now, like, that I look back at it, and thankfully I got back into treatment. I got a bed 3 weeks later and I went to Brewery, and it was 13th June, 2013. That was my last drink, please God. And again, Mark to the rescue.
I wouldn't go that far now, to be fair. I suppose, again, like, a nice little segue to bring me into it, but I wouldn't go that far. And like earlier, I know there's a long period there in what she's talking about, from that wedding moment to going into and coming out of Brewery. Because we didn't break up on that wedding, believe it or not. Forgive, as bad and all as it got, like, we said we'd work, try it, give it a go again, but loads of other things happened again after, the behaviour wasn't there, and I just said enough. But, like, we stayed in contact prior to that. You know, when Suze went home living with her family home at home, like, we kept in contact. I couldn't break contact, you know, as in, like, I was just confused. I was lost myself. I was a completely different individual and man back then than I am now, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally myself, like, you know. A lot of other stuff going on outside of that, like, so I just wasn't in the place to actually fully see what was going on and you know, be fully there, like, because I thought I'd done everything. Mm. And I thought I'd tried everything, and enough was enough. But when I think back there, and if it was like, the help wasn't help at all, because I didn't even know what I was helping or against, you know. Mm. But there was just something pulling me back the whole time. And like, we've spoken about this so many times. I can actually bring it back to the very first night we met. Well, not the first night, the second night, the second day, when we just speaking with no drink, like, for hours on end. And it kind of etched in my mind. And it's almost like I'm really grateful for this now as well. Like, it's like I was able to see beyond the troubled soul at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I was seeing beyond, even though when I was in it, I hated it. Like, and we fucking, like, pardon again, we had a war, like, back then, before I knew, before there was an actual proper prognosis, right? We used to have war, like, because I just thought, this is Sue's overdoing it, because, like what she had said, this is the way it's done where I'm from. Do you know what I mean? What the fuck is wrong with you, Kerry, man? You've got the problem. And in this respect, we're living together. I'm asking you to do something. You're not doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to give you everything outside of this. Just, you know, work with me, la 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 la, you know? So, like, and there was war, because when I get going myself, like, I'm not proud of it. Like, I'm fiery, like, and we did have EastEnders fucking arguments, like, do you know what I mean? We'd do Danny Darbar.
I could see an Alfie Moonshot tonight. You know what I mean?
But I suppose with the, I just need, like, I couldn't cut ties, and, but I knew I didn't want to kind of be doing too much in that first round either, like, because I didn't know where we were going in the relationship, so I didn't want to, like, I was half in, if you will, like, so that's why I just sent the letters, and I sent the cigarettes, and, like, but I kind of wanted her family to step in, really, like, in relation to support, because I thought that would do her good and do them good as well, like, so I stepped back from that. But again, foolishly, I get the letter, everything's going great. I was almost looking at it, kind of going, Jesus, Susan's passing this with flying colours down there. I kind of thought, okay, Susan will come out now, she'll have her shit together. We'd kind of be able to do stuff technically if we were to get back together, but just not Susan drinking, like, but like that a lot of things could continue in the same vein, you know. Mad silly, like, when I think back of it now. But like, when she did, I was completely oblivious as well to the whole addiction process, as in the addiction process itself, and more importantly, the recovery process, you know. And particularly when she came out first, I had no idea, like, that actually relapse was part of the process. And I didn't discover this till, like, a couple of years later, like. And, like, I wish if I had a time machine to go back and I was even privy to that, I might have had a different mindset and a different approach when she came out initially. But I was completely oblivious to all that. Like, and, like, I collected you from Fernand's. Do you know, as in, even though we weren't together, I still went down and collected you from Lance and another friend, or a girl that you'd met in there and stuff. But it was only when kind of Suze went into Brewery then the second time round. Well, like, that 3 week gap was horrendous, like, and we, like, really, really bad, like, some really bad instances there now, like, that we probably won't bring up, like, but she had, like, when I think back, the courage and strength to go into the second treatment again, like, but when I saw that, I said, right, I'm going to make more of a conscious effort this time. I still didn't know where we were going to end up, but I said, you know what? I'm going to step up a small bit more than I had done previously. And then as that round of treatment went on and on, and I saw how hard she was working up there, because I used to go up visiting every second Sunday. Her mother used to go up one Sunday and I used to go up the second Sunday. And I used to ring, I think it was, Jesus, it was a 10-minute phone call every Friday or whatever day it was in at a certain time. Do you know, I used to do that. And when I saw all the work that she was putting in above there in Brewery and kind of experiencing it firsthand, I remember the first day I went in there, I thought, like, it was daunting. Do you know, you touched on it earlier, like, when you said about how hard it is to see someone that you care about in pain or hurting themselves. I remember walking in, going in the first day, like, and, like, I was just, it was like I was hit straight away with this, such emotion, like, because I saw, you could see the pain in it, like, there was so much pain in the room when you went in, but behind it all, like, I remember you could see such determination and hope behind it as well. Like, and I really started seeing that in Susan and seeing it grow over that 3 month period. And I started talking a lot to counselors up there. Two in particular, Kathleen was in that. Kathleen was one lady, and Trevor, I think, at the time. Yeah. And like, they were kind of educating me, really. Like,
and did you just,
Do you know when the relapse still happened? Did you take that as a personal attack on you? Like, did you take that like at this stage? No, you were starting to obviously research addiction anyway, just to understand it a little bit.
I hadn't really done it, delved into it at that stage at all. Like, to be fair, and there's a huge part of me that wished that I had, but. Like, I just got so mad, like, because I thought, like, and again, when I think back, like, that was the symptom. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't, like, the madness. Like, when I think back, there was fear, there was confusion. Like, I would have kind of classified myself as kind of logical or somewhat intelligent, and I was kind of doing the maths in it. She did a great treatment. She's in great form. She's coming out. She's allegedly going to all these meetings. Do you know, because and aftercare and whatnot. I mean, and then this, I couldn't figure it out. And then I thought, like, it was just a tsunami again of feelings and just anger, and it was just an overreaction at the time. And like, I suppose I took it to your point, a bit of disrespect again in my regard. But I just felt lost as well. I thought, you know what, like, I'm out of my depth here. Like, as in this is too big for me. I'm fighting a losing battle, like, silliness. And you know what? When I think back, I'm honest enough and brave enough to say, like, there was a bit of victim mentality in myself as well. Poor me. Mm-hmm. You know, what did I do to draw this on myself? Why do I have to shoulder this burden? You know, that kind of thing. So that kind of led to that. But then, like I said, I did decide to start going into it. But to your earlier point as well, it's when I started observing what was going on above there firsthand, as opposed to just reading letters like the first time, and visibly seeing the change, but hearing it from the counsellors. Yeah. Like, they spoke to me, us collectively first. We had a couple of collective meetings, three of us. Trevor did a few times. Kathleen did three of us a few times. But then I met with them myself, one-on-one as well. Like, and I got so much from that, because they kind of stirred the fire in me then to kind of go, right, I need to educate myself here, because I don't know, like, I don't know who I'm fighting. I don't know who's in the opposite corner here. Like, I thought it was one thing, but there's a way more going on here. Like, so then I started going away to do that. And I kind of took that 3 month period, like, we were still up in the air, like, and I still didn't, you know, we still didn't know what was going on, but there was a lot going on in that particular period. But I remember, if Susan doesn't mind me saying this as well, that, like, you got to a stage, I don't know how long you were from the end of the treatment, that you had enough. She had enough. She was pulling the pin. She was sick of it. Like, she'd sent me a letter highlighting that. I remember you saying it to me on the phone. Like, I didn't know what to kind of say, but that lady that I'm talking about, Kathleen, she actually rang me about it as well directly to tell me, and just kind of said how imperative it was that Sue's just stay the course, that she's actually doing really, really well. And but that's imperative that she finishes out her term, like, and she kind of put it on me, not put it on me, like, but just to kind of see would I talk to her, to see if I could kind of get through to her to stay.
What kind of head state were you in at that time, Susan, inside? What was driving you out?
I hated every minute of the second treatment, unlike the first one. I didn't have any peace of mind. I didn't trust anything I said. I was even afraid to share meetings, and I was saucy with it, do you know, because I was angry, I was bitter, I was angry at myself, do you know what I mean? And I remember going into the meetings, and, you know, they'd be saying, going around us, whatever, say if it was a gratitude week, and they'd come to me and I'd say, girl, don't bother asking me, try not going to lie anyway, look what I did.
Sounds and I like you were grieving.
Do you know, I was stuck, I couldn't move, and she was like, well, that's not going to help. I was like, well, didn't have the first time. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, probably victim mentality. Do you know what I mean? Good. But I tried this. I did 3 months. Lord, this really worked. He made me worse. That was my thing, actually. He made me this. He really highlighted my problem. I'm screwed all together. And I wanted to leave. But, like, it was one, Kathleen, that woman, she was amazing. I remember she said to me, once she just said to me, to what? Leave to what? Where are you going? I swear to God, I never wanted to knock someone out so much in my whole life, because reality was, to what? To nothing. And I was like, you just get a moment, you have to think. And I was running, like, do you know what I mean? And I was like, she was like, where do you live? Or have you a job to go to that you haven't told us about all along? Is there someone you need to save? And I was like, oh my God. She was like, you're leaving to drink, like. And I was like, I'm not, how dare you? She was right, like, do you know what I mean? And because Mark had started coming up to see me, I was getting like a glimmer of hope, but I was afraid as well, do you know what I mean? And I was trying to become very self-reliant again, which is, I am a very resilient woman, always have been, to my detriment at times. So I was trying to balance that. I was like, I wanted him, I needed him, but I needed me more, because if I didn't have me, I'd nothing. And if I came out then, I'd have nothing at all. So I was all over the shop, do you know what I mean? But the fact that what I did find really good was the fact that Kathleen spoke to Mark about addiction, because I felt like nothing I said was being believed anymore. Everything I said was lies, do you know? And that was my perception of it. And she said to me, no, I can tell him, like, that 90% of people do relapse, like, it's part of the process. And I was like, but they think I'm making this shit up, like.
Huge penny drop there for me was that, when I heard that. I was like, what? Isn't, like, that's such a vital piece of information. I was thinking, why am I only hearing this now? Like, not that I was blaming Kathleen or anyone else for only telling me no, but like, I was just kind of going, geez, that's vital. As in, like, for anyone like that's on this side of the table, like, that's something like that anyone.
When I was in the detox for methadone and Valium and that, there's 12 of us in the detox, and one of the counselors was after saying, like, oh, there's the 12 of you that's here. Not to the whole group, no, just in a conversation, you know. He said, out of the 12 of you that's here, only 2 or 3 you will stay sober. You make sure that you're one of the 2 or 3 gems. And
I've heard the same, yeah.
And I said, you know what, I will not be the fucking 90%, you know what I mean? I'll do what I have to take.
Yeah.
And it was that realisation of, what are you leaving to, James? You've destroyed everything. Mm-hmm. You've burnt every bridge you ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents are shocking. You've no assets. You've no education, employment, nothing. You have nothing. What are you leaving for? And you just have to stick it out. But can I ask you a little bit about how you found early recovery, getting out, and how you changed your mindset?
What I literally did, and I swear to God, was I did another treatment when I came out, didn't I?
Yeah.
When I came out, me and Mark again, we were still up in the air, but he had been supportive and said, look, I'll step in here and you can come and stay with me. And I was like, oh my God, amazing. And he said, like, with no drink, do you know what I mean? There can't be drink. And I was like, oh God, how am I going to do that? But I was like, I'm really going to try. Like, I was like, and I didn't want to be like white knuckle sober, but I didn't even know any of that shit meant. I was just like, I have to try. And Kathleen sat me down, and it was just like, again, reflection, but psychoeducation and explaining it to me. Do you know, she was like, Susan, if you go out right, and if you don't drink for 3 months, your percentage drops to, I think she said like 40. She was like, you know, if you don't drink for another 3 months, 10. And I was like, fuck off. She was like, yeah, and I was like, oh, so like if I do this again? And she was like, yeah, you've already done 3 months that you came back to treatment. You've done another 3 months. So I was like, so like if I do week 1 to 12 like I did in here? And she was like, yeah. And I came out and I sat out, Mark, and I was like, so that's what I'm going to have to do. And he was like, right, so what's the plan? I was like, so I have to do it like as if I'm in treatment. So I have to go to a meeting in the morning, meeting in the afternoon, meeting in the evening. And I have to pray for 10 o'clock to come, that I don't drink, go to bed and get up and pretend I'm grateful. Whatever, I'll do whatever. If you're going to tell me, run up down the street naked, I'll do it, because I've suffered enough, I've done enough. And I just, that's exactly what I did. So in my mind, it was my third treatment. So then I was in the 40s. Remember I was saying to you,
yeah.
I'm in the 40% now.
Yeah.
I have a chance now, like. Yeah. I was like, I'd be very determined anyways. I was like, I have a fighting chance now. 9 to 1, I was like, God's really against me. 4, I was like, I could do that, like, do you know what I mean? And then I just started, I suppose, I didn't go back to retail. I switched jobs completely because my mindset had changed, because this is not against retail, I did it for years, and I know I love getting dressed up and stuff, but I just thought it was very shallow. Like my thinking had changed, do you know what I mean? I actually wanted to help people, do you know? I was like, God almighty, that's lousy, like. I think what I went through, I was like, that's lousy on people. So I wanted to actually help people. So I just, that's what I just, my focus was that, getting through the day. And I always say to people when they say, like, is it hard? Oh my God, it was so hard. That first 3 months, that 3 months was harder than treatment. But it was worth it.
It's easy to stay sober in the residential treatment centre. It's the, when you get out, is the big challenge.
Yeah.
And you're right to leave the job, because there's so many triggers involved in that lifestyle, you know. And what kind of career path did you go down? What did you end up doing?
So I remember I went into it, I don't even know, Cork City Planners, you think up in the north side. I was up with the doctor, Nick Flynn, who you'd on.
Yeah.
And I went in, and this one said something about a sea scheme, and here I was, well, what's that? And she was like, community employment scheme. I was like, I never heard of that in my life. But again, right people, right time, curious, you know, and I said it, and it was a health promotion job came up in the centre, and I was like, girl, I'd sell anything. Health, not a bother. I was like, I'm in top form at the moment. So I did that for 2.5 days. Yeah. And
it was such an important move, that.
Yeah. And it just took me down a different avenue of helping people, and that kind of, I think that you would have seen the massive change then.
Yeah, I think, like, maybe, to just go back to, like, to one thing, and then to come up on it, when Helen said that to me and the penny dropped about relapse, it gave me a different, like, it put a different perspective and complexion on what had happened in the after the first treatment, you know, over the 3 week period, do you know. Mm-hmm. So it kind of took a load off, and it just changed the way I looked at that period, and then it lowered the judgment that I threw at her, and all the, like, I didn't feel as lost. Like, I just got so much from that. I can't probably articulate myself well enough now on that, like, but getting that realization, it certainly was a game changer for me, or the first of many game changers. But then to Susan's, when she came out, we had that, the key was we had real conversations, because we were doing it while we were in treatment, while she was in treatment, and we were doing it in that collective environment with Kathleen and Trevor. So when she came out, we got to have that conversation right from the off. I'm going to attack it 3 months. Okay, let's plan it. And Navy SEALs, let's work the problem. 3 foot world, you know, this is our 3 foot world now. Let's work this problem. Talked it out. Meetings was the big key. Like, what could I do to kind of help? And just to show that I'm more supportive than I had been previously. I used to walk her to meetings. The odd time, you know, collect her outside the door, walk her back. Like anytime. She'd see something come on. Like, I suppose in one sense, I think back, it was the beginning of a positive change in me as well in relation to it, but I still had an awful lot of work to do. And again, I'm fine admitting that, because it's a long, arduous process. Mm-hmm. And like it's different stages. And I mean, I was still binary enough in my mm-hmm. approach, in that it was the meetings, or it was not, you know, it was nothing. As in, I felt like, okay, tangibles, like controllables here, like, what tangibles can I do to help, to support Susan? I can help her financially. I can put a roof over her head. You know, I can help her, like, all the basic needs, you know, I can take that out of the mix. But I mean, I still wasn't, even though I was doing it a small bit, there was plenty more that I could have been doing that I know now that I could have been doing back then. But that's where I focused on. And even to her, Susan's last point with that job, like, it was imperative for me that she left retail, because of the superficial nature of it. And not only that, the whole social aspect of it, I knew it was too much for her to ask, and the high pressure. I mean, she used to be under immense pressure there for targets, and in that kind of a world, it's all target driven.
Retail is a tough gig.
It's nuts, especially when you're a manager. So the fact that she got into that, and the helping people, and the irony of it all, like, we were living in Grant Street at the time. I was renting in Grant Street with my brother, and we were going to move prior to that, when Susan was in our treatment. We were going to move, and there was something, just, we were in the process of looking to try and move, and then this happened, and lo and behold, Susan went for an interview, and it was in the Sexual Health Centre, which is just around the corner from Grant Street. And I just said, look, my God, like, as in, here's another technical tangible here now, hold on to this apartment. She can start off this movement, and she's literally walking to and from the job.
No, but it shows as well, and it was my experience in recovery too, and Timmy's. You know, when you come into recovery and you start doing the right things, the opportunities, the doors just open for you. 100%. The opportunities come your way, Timmy, don't they?
100%.
Yeah, everything opens up. You have this to be here, sorry. Jesus. I was like a fella at the back of the car, the microphone. Sorry. It's like...
But you have to want it, though. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And you have to work for it.
Yeah, it's not handed, shall I? Do you know what I mean? I think people think, like, oh, these things will just start unfolding if you do the right things.
Yeah. That's all in the effort.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of people, I always emphasise this when I'm ever talking to anybody in an early recovery. It's one thing to put a drink down and a drug, but, like, you're left with all the behaviours that you learnt during the addiction. You know, a lot of them could be stealing, a lot of them could be violence, could be just anger, attitude problems. These are all behaviours, mm-hmm. right? They're the things you have to start working on when you put all these things down to be able to live a normal life. Mm-hmm. Like, a normal life now would be somebody that I looked up to in early recovery. Somebody, like, when I was in early recovery, I would have jumped in front of a car because I wanted it so much.
Yeah.
Because I was just, the pain that I went through in addiction, you know, it was... was pain, mm-hmm. was raw pain, you know, and it's just the behaviours are critical mm. to anybody's recovery, because if you're still doing the same things, I was inside in prison in early recovery, and I was told before I went in there by people, places and things to me, watch where you're going, watch the people you're around, you know, and just be very, very careful. And I just kept that in my head, kept it in my head. I was on the landing with my own brother and I had to keep my distance because, you know, not because we were arguing or anything like that, because I needed to be on that level, straight path where I had the blinkers on, where it was just all recovery, you know, and I had to look at all the behaviours that got me into prison in the first time, you know, I had to look at myself, you know, and you spoke about it well ago, about looking in the mirror. When I looked in the mirror in early recovery, I was seeing somebody that I'd never seen before. I had absolutely no awareness ever in my life. And for the first time, I was looking at this person in the mirror, and what I was seeing was all the bad stuff that I'd done in my past. You know, all the shame I had, the fear, the guilt for all the people I was after hurting along my journey in addiction. You know, and there's a lot of violence in that. There was crime. You know, you both know how it is, mm-hmm. you know, so they're very, very important things, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was something, we touched on something else there, and I'm finishing this, I'll let it continue. I fought at the beginning in early recovery, not for me, but for the people that I loved around me. I never wanted to stop, never. Mm-hmm. And there was times while I was inside in that prison, I wouldn't be praying for recovery. I'd be praying that my wife would leave me so I could go back to my old life. She's my wife now. Back then, she was my partner. I would, because that would be an excuse for me to go back using. You know, that's very important as well, you know. So
before we finish up, Susan, have you anything to promote or anything coming up? Or?
Do you know what? The only thing I'd be... Well, the main thing to promote is actually recovery. And honestly, like... For me, it was about just getting honest. Do you know, the minute when people come into recovery, we think that we have to do it a certain way, or, do you know, we have to follow this person because they're doing it that way. Do you know what? Just be honest with yourself. Like, if you can look, that mirror thing is something that I live by. If you can look at yourself square in the mirror and go, I am doing my best, like, and I'm not bullshitting a bullshitter, like, I mean it. Do you know, you're in with a chance, like, and anyone can get well. But as long as you keep doing that, and I would have been very abstinence based because that's the treatment I received, and that's the only exposure I'd have had. Like, I'm now an addictions counsellor myself, and I'm a general counsellor, but I specialise in addiction.
Yeah.
And I'm not a one size fits all. Whereas harm reduction to me years ago, before I was educated, was like the devil. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I look at things like holistically, and I say, look, what's doing harm? What's served me well, what's not served me well. Mm. And when people come into recovery, yeah, you have to change, but you don't have to lose who you are. Mm. Do you know what I mean? The core of who we are and when we're born is a beautiful person. Yeah. That person is still there. Do you know, I don't think we have to just become a sheep and suddenly become cult orientated and we're all the same. You know what I mean? Like, be yourself and enjoy life. Because why get sober and clean if you're just going to be miserable? Do you know what I mean? You should be enjoying it.
Yeah.
And you should be able to be honest with people in your life that are in your life. Because if you feel like you have to lie to them to be good, then maybe move to someone else. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Well so said. Well, look, lads, it was a pleasure to have both of you on.
Thanks,
tough topic. Myself and Timmy might branch into couples counselling. What do you reckon, Jack?
Most definitely. Another point there before you finish up. How can people reach you if they are looking for any form of counselling off you?
Yeah, thanks, Timmy, for that. I'm on Twitter, Person Supported Therapy. And my number's up there. So Susan Galvin, even though I didn't change, we might have finished on a high there, boys, before we divorced tonight. I didn't change my name yet, but I did on Twitter. So Susan Galvin, and it's all my information's up there. So yeah, people can contact me there.
What about yourself, Mark? Have you anything to add for anyone that's going through similar struggles yourself?
As in like. It really is such it's a long process and it's not an easy fix. And like we spoke at length, myself and Susan, lead up to this podcast as well, like just having conversations about stuff. And like there's so many things that goes on from the other side of the table as well. Like, and I think like the fact, you know, in the early days, there's definitely, what terminology do we use when we were talking about it? It's not a confrontation, but I suppose it's kind of like you're competing with each other, really, in relation to the burdens or the sacrifices that you have to make from either side of the table. Like, and in the early days, like you're going to the non addict or like myself in this scenario, like I other non drink related. Issues that were on the table that were kind of consuming me and other burdens and stuff out of it. And you had to be kind of your own certain worries and you're kind of vying. There was times I felt like, oh yeah, I wish I was a fucking addict now, actually, because maybe we would be on a level par. I know it's silly, like, and it's madness that we'd be on a level par now in this particular argument. But there is a degree of that, like, and I mean, if I could kind of have a conversation with my old self there in relation to that, like, and things that I would have done better. Like, I mean, I wish back then, like, that I had educated myself more on the whole process, as in, like I was saying earlier, addiction itself, but the process that's involved in recovery, but also, like, to acknowledge, like, that it's okay to feel annoyed with her or angry with her or pissed off at her, or that it's a natural response to actually feel like, why do I have to compete with you here now? Why are my worries or my problems not big enough when they're put up against addiction or sobriety? Like, it's silly, like, but I mean, it's just a natural kind of thing that you'd have. But like, the more I learned about the holistic thing that is addiction and in turn recovery, like, and realized and learned that it's like the drink is only the symptom, like that it's not just an alcohol thing, you know, that there's mental health, there's emotion, there's loads of other things going on, like. And I think the more I learned about it, basically, and the greater our communication got, like, the more it helped. I mean, you look at us now, we think like we're far from the Waltons, like we've had war, like, but like, I almost had to go through a number of the 12 steps myself as well, on top of what I'm talking about and in particular what always comes to mind is acceptance, gratitude and the present. Because in the early days I didn't have the gratitude because I wanted more. I wasn't present because I was always thinking about, I had a goal that was around the corner or next month or the month after. I couldn't just stay in the present. Like, and even when I think of acceptance, I know now, I look back, I was aware of it to a certain degree. I could acknowledge that I knew it, but I didn't accept it for a very long time. As in, I didn't accept, even though Susan had said it, I'm an alcoholic and gone through treatment. I didn't accept that, like really, really, truly accept it, that I was actually going out with initially and then fell in love with and ended up marrying, like, an actual alcoholic. It took me a very long time to actually realize it. I thought I had accepted it, but I didn't fully. And it's only when I did that I was actually able to process it properly in myself, and that I felt a lot of, looking back, I carried a lot of guilt because I felt like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this, or I shouldn't be doing that, or I shouldn't have enabled that, or, you know, there was a lot of guilt there. And that fed a lot of resentment then as well. Carried a lot of resentment as well. It took me a long time to get rid of that. But I mean, all I can say to anyone, like, anything I've said tonight comes with caveats, and anything that we've done or tried or felt, like, it isn't the one hat fits all. Like, that's just kind of like what's happened to us to date and what's worked for us to date. But like, I foolishly thought back then, like, that Suze has to do the 12 steps. She has to own that. Like, and I can just be there, like I was saying earlier, tangibly be there, but add in like the walking to the meetings, more conversations, etc. But I don't have to live the steps because I don't have a problem with drink. Mm-hmm. But you, like, to my mind, I think there has to be some degree. And even if it's those three pillars, proper acceptance of what's going on, full awareness, like, of the enormity of it, and your responsibility and role within actually dealing with that, being grateful for every little win, every little day, you know, and present.
And there is support for families out there, and if anybody wants to contact us, we can link them in with support. We're going to have to leave it there before the batteries go dead, right? But thank you, Susan.
Thanks,
you look beautiful. You present really well. You speak really well, as always. It's great to talk to you.
Great,
Mark, you did brilliant.
My pleasure. I did tell you to start. I warned you that I can go on a bit like so.
Well, you're lucky we have good batteries, don't you?
you are a star of the show today.
I doubt that, no. Yeah. No, it was a privilege to be on here, to be fair.
No, you did really well. You know, you covered a topic with a lot of dignity and a lot of respect and a bit of humour as well. And you're going to help a lot of couples in similar situations. So thanks for that. And thanks, Timmy. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks, Ron.
And, cheers, guys. Appreciate
it. See everybody again next week. See you later.
Bye.
Take care. Thanks, guys.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe. And don't forget to head over to the Patreon if you'd like to help us. Thanks again.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.